Hello and welcome to Political Heat. I'm your host, Amy Mount, and in this episode, I want to put climate politics and the movement of people campaigning for climate action in a broader context. Political cultures develop differently in different countries, and that's true whether you're looking at the official spaces of policymaking or the surrounding worlds of campaigning and advocacy. And climate politics in the UK today owes a great deal to previous struggles over environmental issues. For decades, if not centuries, these focused on the conservation of and access to our green and pleasant land. And campaigners today have inherited ideas, tactics, and relationships from that long tradition of British environmentalism. It's also shaped how climate change is understood by the different political parties and by the institutions of government itself. I'm really pleased to be joined for this episode by Dame Fiona Reynolds. She has delved deep into the history of our environmental politics and written about it in her book, The Fight for Beauty. And I'm keen to talk with Fiona about the links between the climate community and other strands of environmentalism, and also to consider what they can continue to learn from each other. Fiona knows a great deal about all this, as she has participated in some iconic struggles for the environment and worked for some of its best known organisations. Fiona was Director General of the National Trust from 2001 to 2012. Before that, she led the Women's Unit in the Cabinet Office and ran the Council for the Protection of Rural England. After a spell as Master of a Cambridge College, she became Chair of the National Audit Office, as well as of several other bodies, including the Royal Agricultural College and the Bennett Institute for Public Policy. Fiona, welcome to Political Heat.
Thank you.
So to begin with, I wonder, what made you want to write about the fight for beauty, and why did you decide to frame it in that way?
Well, I've been involved in the environmental movement in a very broadest sense all my adult life. And I think what has driven me throughout has been that sense of being part of a long tradition of people caring about and campaigning for beauty. And I need to be clear at the beginning that beauty isn't an aesthetic or a sort of physical thing. For me, beauty is a shape of mind. It's about how we think about what we value. And in particular, it's about valuing the non-material things in life, everything from bird song in the spring to feeling enveloped by sort of love of place and a sense of belonging. And so that deep sense of beauty has been central, actually, to our society for many, many hundreds of years. But it's kind of got lost and kind of got displaced by modern, frankly, quite materialistic language, such as technical terms, I don't know, like biodiversity instead of nature, or ecosystem services, or even the technical language surrounding climate change. And I was really keen to just call back this fundamental human need to feel at one with our planet and with our lives, and to revive the idea that beauty matters.
And what do you think was the cost that came with forgetting to think about it in those terms? What was the problem there?
I think the problem was we reduce everything to very material language and judgments that almost if you can't count it, it doesn't matter, and a very technical discourse. And what I was trying to communicate, and what I feel has been central to the organisations I've been involved with, is just this idea that, you know, we are a humanity that is searching for a kind of reconciliation with the natural resources on which we depend, and with the idea that we have responsibilities as well as taking from our natural world. And this has all become, I think, really clear now with the convergence, which is now beginning to happen between the climate and nature crises. But it's still often quite deterministic in its language and in the judgments. And I feel we need to get back almost to the soul of our movement. And think beauty is a wonderful way of capturing that. It's partly because it is a very human word, and partly because it absolutely is about the things that money can't buy.
Yeah, and I suppose listening to you talk there, it also is a term that links together our natural heritage and our cultural heritage, doesn't it? With the two strands of, for example, what the National Trust works on, and it's something that brings them into conversation really neatly.
Yes, it does. But it actually, the roots of it, I think, go back to very, very early times. And I often quote Chaucer, who wrote, "It was the beauty of an April spring that longen folk to go on pilgrimages." Now, can you imagine that sort of wonderful idea of people seeing the kind of joys of an April spring, which we're almost having this year, and actually wanting that, inspiring them to go on pilgrimages. And beauty and the language of beauty has suffused literature, poetry, music, you know, writing of all kinds in this country for centuries. And it was in the 18th century picked up and made important by Pope and by Capability Brown and others who were sort of drawing on those ideas. And then, of course, the 19th century, which is when I think the environmental movement really began, with people like Ruskin, appalled by the way industrialization was destroying places and qualities which were irretrievable as a result of the dominion of man. And, it, you know, he was using quite emotional but also quite philosophical language to champion just different values, a different value set, and a different way of looking at the world.
And just while we're on language, I think it's quite striking that you talk about campaigning as a fight. And I suppose it's not the typical language that we hear from Oxbridge College masters or chairs of public bodies. So why do you see it in that way?
I see it in that way because it jolly well was a fight. And the more you read about it and the more you look into it, the more you realise that these individuals have had to stand up against the prevailing orthodoxy and the prevailing determinism, you know, very often driven by material values, and fight, literally fight, both intellectually fight, but protest in the streets, you know, have really had to make the case for beauty, but also for the environment. And I don't think we should delude ourselves. This is not a sort of genteel spectator sport. It's been one in which people have given their lives and given their whole commitment to trying to secure a different way of thinking about the future.
And I wonder if there's one or two individuals from that fight who've particularly inspired you.
Well, they have, yes, and actually they're women mostly. And when I started work in 1980, which feels a very long time ago now, there were a few women who were great, great mentors, but also just heroines for me. One of them I'm just about to celebrate was Ethel Haythornthwaite, who founded the Sheffield and Peak District CPRE back in 1924, actually before CPRE existed. So she was there, and she was an extraordinary woman, and she died in 1986, so I didn't know her for very long, but she was an incredible, passionate woman. And then two more, Sylvia Sayer, who campaigned for Dartmoor all her life, and she was formidable. I mean, people were terrified of her. And she used to stride across the military lands on Dartmoor while they were firing, knowing that nobody would fire on her because they were all so frightened of her.
Wow.
And then the third one I'd mention is Esme Kirby, who was very much alive when I started. I used to see her a lot because Snowdonia is one of my favourite places, and she was chairman of the Snowdonia Society. And she, again, she was absolutely formidable and made a big difference, all of them, by being unafraid, by fighting, by being crystal clear that there were values which were at risk of being lost and places that were perishing because of a lack of care for them. And really, you know, were very, very inspiring women. So that was in my lifetime. But, you know, further back, Octavia Hill is one of my great heroines of all time, one of the founders of the National Trust in 1895. So there's plenty of people who I feel totally inspired by.
And I always think it's good to look at the individuals. I mean, the movements as a whole is where the power comes from, but looking at the individuals who can often articulate for other people why something matters, or really show through their actions and lead by example. And I think that does have also a kind of power to it, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, because actually you need leaders, you know, you need followers. And by goodness, when it comes to things like climate change, we need everyone to be a follower. But actually, without leaders, you don't have that sort of crystal clarity and sense of ambition and purpose, which, you know, is what has inspired me all my career.
And so, coming to the modern, if you like, British environmental movement, what would you say are the most significant ways it's been shaped by previous struggles, like the ones that you've just been alluding to?
Well, I think the thing that strikes me now is how the different strands of the movement are having to come together, whether they like it or not, actually. And for some, that's more of a challenge than for others. You know, when, again, back in the 80s, when I started, it was very clear there were the nature conservation people, there were the landscape conservation people, there were the green movements, whether that was Friends of the Earth or Greenpeace. You know, there were all these people who were very, very clear about their own purpose and their own ambition. And actually, it took quite a lot of effort to get them to work together. I mean, one of the great things I remember vividly was Peter Melchett bringing together the wildlife organisations under the umbrella of Wildlife Inc., because even the wildlife organisations weren't talking to each other. And now we got expanded to Wildlife and Countryside Link a decade or so later. But actually now, it's no good being in a narrow cleft and sort of sticking to your knitting. We're in a world where we fully understand how everything connects and fully understand all the dependencies, and realise that you can't achieve sustainability without it being a genuine triple bottom line: economy, society and the environment. And actually, everybody's got to work together right across divides of a more obvious kind, you know, developers versus protectionists. But actually, within the broader environmental movement, we need coalitions too. And that, to me, is the challenge of today. It's not about what we're against. That was easy. It's actually, what are we for, and how do we create a belief that a more sustainable future is a good future rather than a hair-shirt future or a compromised future? And that is all about values and all about the way that we frame our own aspirations and those of society.
So I think perhaps professionally, the way that some of these environmental careers have developed, and also as activists, people sign up to particular campaigns or organisations and perhaps identify still with one or other of those different strands that you've mentioned, like I'm a climate campaigner or I'm a nature campaigner or whatever it might be. How do you see those climate identifying people or struggles as linked into that wider environmental tradition at this point?
Well, I suppose that's where I think that beauty is a sort of way in for everybody. And to say not beauty as an aesthetic thing, but beauty as an approach to life. Because if we really want to tackle the climate and nature crises, it's not about passing a law in Parliament or getting somebody to adopt a different policy or by, you know, the conventional lobbying means. It's actually about the whole of society behaving in a way that kind of believes we have a long-term future, actually. And to believe we have a long-term future, we have to think in a completely different way about the way we use natural resources, the rate of exploitation, the kinds of food we eat, the jobs that we do, the way we live our daily lives. The dependence on fossil fuels has to shift, but so has our material culture that says throw something away, buy something new. And in a way, trying to describe that future has been really difficult, and it's been quite divisive. And you get politicians saying, I'm never going to legislate or move fast on certain issues because I can't carry public opinion with me. And other people saying, well, you've got to, because if you don't, you know, we're all going to hell in a handcart. And it becomes very contested territory. And so one of the things I suppose I was trying to do by using beauty is saying, actually, if beauty is, if you like, a way of describing a world where we're satisfied with less, where we believe that non-material progress is as important as material progress, where we value the things that money can't buy, that we content with life rather than always striving for more material gain. You know, it becomes hopefully a way of saying we can help with that big societal adjustment. But it is about values. It is about what we think progress looks like. It's about how we measure progress. It's about how we describe what makes us happy and what makes us content. And it's, while money and sort of ever more material gain is often used, you know, in the public domain about, so constantly hearing about, is GDP going up? What a disaster. It's not. Actually, when you talk to people as individuals, that's not really what makes them happy. And so trying to find ways of building more confidence in a future that is soundly based on sustainable and long-term goals. And beauty just seemed to me to be a way of articulating some of those non-material elements.
But just to push on that a little bit, I mean, I think that's perhaps true as far as it goes, but there are still huge parts of society and other parts of the world that are crying out for more material gain, and, you know, whose basic needs are not being met, and we've got this cost of living crisis here in the UK. So how do you square that sort of vision that's moving away from the material with those real needs that people still have?
Oh, I absolutely accept that there are massive inequalities in society, massive issues around, you know, not just the distribution of wealth, but the absolute wealth or lack of it of many people. So it's not disconnected from that. And actually, some people have challenged me and said, oh, beauty is a sort of word for the middle classes. It's something you can have when your basic needs are met. But actually, I don't believe that. I mean, Octavia Hill, who was the founder of the National Trust, but also in her youth, a housing campaigner, I mean, she said beauty was an entitlement that everybody should have. And the way she described it was people who live in abject poverty need a green space for children to play in and need flowers and window boxes if there's no space for a garden. They need, she described it, there's open air sitting rooms for the poor. You know, this idea that, I mean, we wouldn't use that language today, but this idea that in everybody's life, and of course, resolving inequities is a massive political challenge, but everybody is entitled to and should feel that they have things that they respond to emotionally, as well as enough to eat and a place to live. So it's not a sort of thing that you get to when everybody's needs are satisfied, but it's also something that everybody should be entitled to in some way or other.
You're making me think of that song or poem, Bread and Roses. we fight for bread, but we also need roses too.
Exactly. And that was John Muir, you know, the great Scottish advocate of the American national parks. We need beauty as well as bread. You know, this has been absolutely part of the philosophy. It's a very democratic philosophy, as well as something that, you know, I think helps today to talk about the things that matter that money can't buy, but need to be part of the way we think about the future.
And you mentioned politicians earlier and the challenges they have sometimes in showing leadership on environmental issues when they feel like it's in perhaps their constituents, it's not what they expect. But I think Britain's major political parties are interesting and unusual in the degree to which they all have an environmental strand within their own political traditions as well. So I just wondered if you could reflect on to what extent those political parties as kind of institutions with their own values and inheritances have been shaped by environmental ideas and environmental campaigns.
Yeah, I think you're right. And when you look at the global scene, and you probably know it better than I do, but actually we were early with our Climate Change Act, and we were early and for a considerable time leaders in the whole process of international climate negotiations. So we have in all cases had politicians willing to lead. And that's not least because the environmental movement was very effective, but also because at crucial moments it seemed to be backed by electoral concern. So I don't think environmental messages ever land in isolation. They land because people were talking about climate and people were talking about the challenges and the responsibilities in surgeries and in constituency meetings and all the rest of it. And actually, issues like the water quality issue now and the whole question about the future of farming and some of these issues are very much on everybody's minds. I mean, and that's why I think the parties are all, to varying degrees, listening in a way that they probably weren't, well, certainly weren't when I first started 40 years ago. But I don't think that resolves the issue that when push comes to shove and it comes to a choice between do you back fossil fuels or do you back renewables or whatever, that they aren't very, very nervous. And the nearer we get to an election, the more nervous they get. So we're probably in that sort of hyper-aware environment right now where it's actually quite difficult for politicians who are watching like a hawk, focus groups and all the rest of it, that everything seems to stand still. You know, the best time to make progress environmentally is just after an election or just after a major sort of political event. The nearer you get to election, it gets quite difficult. Yeah. So, but I think, you know, it's in our culture, actually, and that, you know, the Conservatives are an interesting party because the sort of, if you like, the One Nation Tories have always been environmentalists. And actually, they've changed with Brexit and the emergence of a very specific right-wing element. They're in a very different place. Whereas Labour are just really watching the centre ground at the moment and very nervous about overcommitting. Look what happened to the 28 billion. So, you know, and the Lib Dems don't feel strong enough, actually, to to be really confident. So there's a particular set of circumstances at the moment which I think are also affecting how confident they are able to be.
And when you talk about the fight for beauty, when you talk about the message of your book with different political audiences, do you get a feel for it being, for those messages being received differently depending on those value traditions that people are coming from?
Yes, I do. And it's interesting. And I'm not particularly optimistic responses. But actually, what is interesting, so Michael Gove picked up the beauty point very specifically. But actually, as far as he's concerned, it's mostly about building more aesthetically pleasing housing. So that doesn't buy the bigger, deeper perspective that I'm talking about. And I think Labour are also, they're much more in tune with this idea that beauty is alongside other values, something that can bring a more democratic approach. They don't use the word very much, they don't talk about it very much, but actually I draw a lot of my analysis from that post-war period of integrated legislative ambitions. So, you know, we needed legislation for jobs and housing and industry and subsidising the sort of economic progress. But we also needed legislation for the welfare state, for health, for the environment, through national parks and nature protection. So that tradition in the Labour Party is still alive. Yeah. But it's not a word that politicians feel comfortable using, for reasons which in some ways are understandable, but that's one of the reasons why I want to revive it, to make it universal again, as it really was until probably about, I don't know, the second half of the last century.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about one of those post-war struggles, which I think is still relevant today and a sort of great example of a wider point. So the struggle for access to the countryside, because I think one of the things that it did, it clearly put landowning aristocrats on the defensive, but the coalition campaigning for that access, it did involve a cross-section of society. And so I was just wondering about your view on how environmentalism, environmental politics, sits across these wider political dividing lines of wealth and class, because those dividing lines have been dominant themes of British political history. They still are, and still, as you were alluding to earlier, sometimes environmental politics gets dismissed as, oh, it's just the concern of a particular class. But I think that access to the countryside example is a good, you know, relatively early example of why that doesn't have to be the case.
Yeah, and of course in its early days it was a class war. You know, it was the urban booted hiker wanting to get out onto the moors owned by the rich privileged landowner. But actually that sort of stereotype is long, long gone, and there've been a couple of moments which I think have really changed things. I mean, the first was foot and mouth, actually, back in 2001 when the countryside was closed. And oh my goodness, did all the people running rural businesses, all the heritage locations, but also all the big landowners who had, I don't know, tea shops and pubs and loads of elements of their rural businesses were completely cut off from income sources. It wasn't for very long, actually, looking back on it. It was relatively few weeks, three or four months. But actually, there's a sea change at that point into realising that, well, access is really valuable part of the rural economy and much, much more of a contributor to the sustainability of rural areas than anybody had really, if not understood before, but sort of seen so visually illustrated. And I think the same sort of thing happened with COVID, where, and this has certainly made a difference to the government, where, you know, the one thing we were all allowed to do was to go for a walk. And it's absolutely highlighted people's need, very Octavia Hill sort of need for access to nature, green space. And in fact, the government picked that up. It's the one post-COVID policy that is sort of absolutely based on nature, people's entitlement to be in nature in some shape or form. So I think the access movement has gone through several iterations and is now in it, that it is universally seen as important that people do get the chance to walk and to experience nature and to have access to it in the way that is no longer that this is our land and you're going to stay off it, which was that sort of 1930s caricature.
Yeah. And there's a, just coming back to the campaigning side of things as well, I came across a quote recently about, and I can't remember the name of the person, but it's a US environmentalist who talks about being a part-time campaigner, because you need to, any individual, but it's almost especially if you're fighting for the future of the planet, it's so important to get out there and be in wild places, be surrounded by greenery and bird song, and remember what it's all for, and get restored by that. Because if you're just sat there in front of your laptop all the time, you'll burn out, but also lose some of that essential kind of inspiration that you need to fuel you.
Yeah, well, that is exactly, that's the beauty argument, that, that, you know, your whole life is lacking unless you have that sort of form of succour, that connection, and whether that's divine through access to nature or being part of a place that you love and that you feel gives you that kind of strength and encouragement, it's absolutely core to the argument, and it's not a luxury, but it's also something you can't do without.
So it's great we're having this conversation, because a lot, if not most, of the guests on Political Heat so far have really focused on the economic arguments for moving to net zero. I think there's a sense that that's what politicians, policymakers want to hear, that's what's really going to swing it for them. Economics and security, in terms of, you know, reducing cost to consumers, supporting growth and prosperity. But as you're saying, that, you know, those kinds of rationales, they're important, but they're not sufficient for driving government policy or for motivating the public. So I wonder, do you think the climate debate in general is falling short in this respect at the moment?
Well, I would love to see almost a philosophical kind of set of arguments emerging around this that talk about the future in terms that demonstrate that we can live lives differently and still have enough to eat, still have somewhere to live, still have, you know, sufficient material goods, and not ignoring your earlier point about, you know, inequities, but actually we can live a meaningful life while doing the work that's needed, both to address climate change, but actually almost more urgently to address the nature crisis. I mean, I genuinely believe that the nature crisis is bigger than the climate crisis, because the nature crisis is the sort of survival of the planet's health, and the climate operates within those goals, not separately from them. And I was part of the Descripta advisory group, and honestly, that was transformational in my mind. But just to understand,
and sorry, just on that, the Descripta, could you just briefly explain what that?
Yeah, so Professor Partha Descripta, who is a professor of economics at Cambridge University, was asked by Sajid Javid, who, when he was the Chancellor, to conduct a review into the economics of biodiversity, very similar to the Stern review, which had been commissioned by the Treasury in, I think, 2008-ish, I can't remember the date. And he's a remarkable man, and everyone assumed it was going to be full of economists, but he grabbed me one day and said, "Fiona, I need you on my review." And I said, "Why? I am not an economist." And he said, "Precisely. I want someone who's going to talk about beauty on my panel and talk about the cultural and, if you like, the kind of human side of it." And then he wrote this beautiful chapter in his 600-page review, which was all about children and nature and the sort of spiritual relationship that we need to have with nature and with beauty. So he, even though he's a very sort of hard-nosed economist at one level, he completely understood that the picture would be incomplete without this philosophical, spiritual aspect. So I just don't think we're going to succeed in addressing these huge challenges if we just look at the economics. The economics, of course, are important, but they're not enough. And we won't actually build the consensus around living our lives differently unless we do take that broader view.
And does anyone come to mind, apart from that chapter in that review, are there any other examples of people who are doing this, who are putting forward that wider case about why this matters?
Well, I think there are people coming at it from different perspectives. So Richard Layard, who talks about happiness, is in that same sort of space. And there's quite a lot of work being done now around what are the societal measures that we should be watching. You know, I've been very critical of GDP, and I will always be very critical of GDP, because it's only an income and expenditure account, whereas there's no balance sheet in GDP, whereas the world fundamentally needs a balance sheet, and it's nature and climate that are the vulnerable issues when you've got no balance sheet, because nobody is thinking about the way we exploit resources and the way we handle those fundamental requirements that we depend on. So all the people who are doing work on well-being indicators and the sort of a much more rounded view of progress are in this space. I mean, I grabbed the beauty word because it just is so central to our movement, and because it was so unfashionable and people were so scared of it, and I wanted to be out there saying, no, stop being scared of it, embrace it, recognise that, you know, people talk about beauty all the time. People understand that it's bigger than just something aesthetic. You know, if you're out in nature and you feel that you're talking about something being beautiful, you're saying so much more than it looks nice, aren't you? You're talking about the feel and the relationship you're having and the kind of sense of purpose and connection. So I just wanted to revive that idea.
So I just want to explore whether there's, despite how you've described it, whether there might be some tensions inherent in this concept as well, because in a previous episode of this podcast, I talked with Emma Pinchbeck, who's CEO of the Energy UK Trade Association, and we were discussing the need for new energy infrastructure. And one of the things she said was that there are political choices about cost and about what happens to the countryside and to beauty, perhaps, if we use your language, because, you know, people might object to pylons, but it's going to be really expensive if we were to underground new cables, and the people who maybe bear the costs of the greater expense are the people who really need cheaper energy bills. So there's all these kind of tensions and politics around that. And I remember when you were running the National Trust, you were involved in a huge campaign when the government proposed some far-reaching changes to planning policy. So I wondered whether you're worried about another possible fight over planning in the next parliament because of this need for new energy infrastructure amongst other infrastructure needs, and how you sort of square that with your concept of beauty and what it's doing for climate and wider environmental politics?
Oh, that's a big question, but it's a really important one. And yes, I do think there's going to be a battle royal over planning, actually, because both Labour and Conservatives see the planning system as getting in the way of progress and needing to make it simpler and faster and all the rest of it. And I actually think we need a sort of rehabilitation of planning campaign, because we can't do anything without planning it in some way. So the idea that it's the planning system that is the evil thing, whereas actually there's lots and lots of evidence that we're pretty poor at planning infrastructure, for example, and pretty poor at some of the processes that would get to better outcomes for people as well as the particular issue that's being fought over, and also for the planet. So I'll just give you one little example. When I was at CPREs, this is going back, there needed to be a high-speed rail through Kent, and everyone was going, this is going to damage the Garden of England, and there's going to be all kinds of rows about it. But actually, CPRE worked very, very closely with the then leader of Kent County Council, who was a man called Sandy Bruce Lockhart, wonderful man, sadly now died. And he said, yeah, I completely get that if you're going to have a fast link to the tunnel, you're going to have to go through Kent. I mean, the geography is unarguable. Mm. But he says it's not going to go through Kent until we've walked the route, we've consulted with all the communities that might be affected, and we found the least damaging route, and we work with everybody to put it in a way that means that it's acceptable, delivers its goals, but also respects Kent and everything that Kent stands for and cares about. So contrast that to HS2, which had none of those processes. It was a line on a map, as a result of which it triggered enormous concern, legitimate concern, which then had to be paid for by hugely expensive mitigation and further inquiries and further process, which everyone then blamed the planning system for. Whereas actually they'd started from the point that they were going to do this in a consultative way, working with organisations and institutions and communities. I'm absolutely confident it would have cost much less at the end of the day and gone in through a better process, but it would not have gone in without planning. It needed the planning process to provide a framework for those discussions to happen. I think the same is going to be true of overhead power lines. I think there is a possibility that there's another way of doing some of it. I mean, there is talk about building a sort of grid around the coast of England so that you could actually bring power ashore in appropriate locations. I don't know about the economics or the viability of that. But I do think if you start from a process that you're going to do things really, really well, people accept quite often there's a principle, we need housing, we need infrastructure. What they hate is it just being imposed on them. And of course they react, and as a result, the process gets slow and expensive. And are we surprised that it's highly contested? So I think we need planning. The planning system is not perfect, but actually what is really not perfect is the way we bring forward major infrastructure changes. And if we could do that better, we'd find a much happier set of outcomes.
So when the leader of the Labour Party talks about standing with the builders, not the blockers, that's perhaps not the way you would frame it.
It's not the way I would frame it at all. And actually, most people in this country absolutely accept there's a need for housing. And if you approach it, I was talking about this very issue the other day, if you approach it from the community base, whether it's a small village or a large town, where is the best place to put the next a lot of housing we need? Most people are really sensitive to affordable housing. That's where the biggest need is. I think you would achieve a lot more quickly than the great big new housing development on the edge of a town and city with no local services, no public transport, no primary school, no shops. So everyone is car dependent and driving in and living in a very unsustainable way. Whereas you could plan it much better if you start from the place and build a vision of a more sustainable future for the way we all live. So I just think we blame the planning system for other failings.
Yeah, this is making me think back to another episode of Political Heat with Professor Rebecca Willis, where we were talking about the need for more deliberation and more involvement of the public in decisions about net zero. And that doesn't mean every single decision about every single policy, but that kind of strategic view of, perhaps I'm putting words in her mouth here, but people should listen to that episode and get a feel for actually, you know, how some of these, as you were saying, like more processes involving dialogue early on can lead to better outcomes for the climate and the environment and indeed the economy.
Absolutely, yeah.
So just a final question then from me, because as you said, you've been participating in the fight for beauty for several decades now, but you don't seem to be showing any signs of stopping. So I wondered, what gives you the energy to carry on?
Oh, I don't know. I'm passionate about England, Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland. I've also worked in to some extent, but mostly I've spent my life working in England. And I'm passionate about finding better solutions to, as I said right at the beginning, these kind of the integrated challenges. You know, I did spend my first 10 years trying to stop horrible things happening in national parks, actually. That was my first job. And when I moved to CPRE, it was a completely different job. It was like, we have to find the places for new development to go, as much as stopping the development we don't want. And that, right from then, I've just felt, how can we honour the beauty of this country while enabling change in a sustainable way that will meet the needs of today's society and better meet the needs of future generations? Because at the moment, we're selling future generations down the line with a climate and nature crisis that we have not yet found solutions to. So that's what keeps me going. And every single morning I set off at 5 o'clock, you know, on my walk, dark or light. Luckily it's getting light now. And I just feel, you know, this matters. I really love this country and want to do my bit.
Well, thank you for an incredible record of service so far and for continuing as you are doing, Fiona. And very many thanks for joining Political Heat. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, thank you, Amy. Lovely to see you. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode, which to me had a different feel to earlier conversations on Political Heat. With previous episodes, guests have talked a lot about power dynamics, electoral arithmetic, geopolitics and economic interests, all of which are super important and all of which we'll keep coming back to. But politics is also about values, traditions and relationships, and that's why I thought it would be good to take a step back and think about how those things are shaping the climate debate today. Whether or not you agree with Fiona Reynolds' concept of beauty, I think she is right to draw our attention to what she called the soul of our movement. It's important to look at where it's come from and where it's going. the soul of our movement influences which fights we choose to prioritise, the outcomes we're trying to achieve, the alliances we build, and it spills over into the wider culture that climate politics sits within. And for what it's worth, I do think the climate movement needs to be fighting for beauty, for meaningful human existence on this precious planet of ours. Do tune in to the next episode. I'll be joined by Caris Roberts, Executive Director of the Institute for Public Policy Research. We're going to be exploring the role of the state in climate investment. If you're enjoying this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe. You can send feedback or suggestions to politicalheatpod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter at politicalheat24. I'm also writing regular newsletters on Substack under the same title, Political Heat. Political Heat was produced and presented by me, Amy Mount. It was edited by Sarah Eldridge. Thanks for listening.